Barbecue the eggplants with peels. Put them in a tray to cool down. Peel off the eggplants and their heads gently. Now slice them on their lengths or mince them completely. Then peel off the tomatoes and grate or puree them. Mince or grate the peeled garlic cloves. Now put some oil in a frying pan and put it on fire to get hot. Pour the garlic in the pan and saute it for 10 seconds. Then add turmeric, black or red pepper. After 1 minute, break the eggs and mix them with garlic. Take the eggs and garlic out and leave them. Pour the tomato puree in the first frying pan and saute it a little. Add the eggplants with some salt and add some oil if needed. Let them cook on mild fire for half an hour. When the eggplant and tomato are mixed well and the mixture is oily, you can add the mixture of garlic and egg. Now, mix everything and then serve it with rice or fresh bread, fresh vegetables, pickled garlic and special olive, seedless olive with pomegranate paste and grated walnuts on it. It should be noted that if you don't like the smell of eggplant peel, you can fry it after peeling it. Mirza Qasemi is a suitable food for vegetarians since it has no meat.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
China's President Xi Jinping has pledged to bolster the country's security and build the military into a great wall of steel to defend Beijing's interests.
So as to guarantee a new development pattern through a new security architecture, we should further advance our mobilization drive in terms of national defense and military, and to turn China's military into a great wall of steel that will effectively defend the country's sovereignty, security, and development interests.
He also stressed the need for an improved national security system as well as an improved social governance system.
Security is the foundation for development. Stability is the prerequisite for prosperity. We should implement a holistic approach to national security and improve our national security system, strengthen our capacity for safeguarding national security, and enhance public safety governance, as well as to improve the social governance system.
He also reiterated Beijing's opposition to secessionist activities and external interference in Taiwan. Xi's remarks came in his closing speech to China's parliament, the National People's Congress, where last week he secured unanimous support for an unprecedented third term in office. During his speech, Xi also said China must achieve greater self-resilience and strength in science and technology, a call that comes as the United States blocks China's access to chip-making equipment and other cutting-edge technologies. Meanwhile, China's premier has said some people in the U.S. have been trumpeting decoupling from China in recent years.
你中有我, 我中有你。 I know that in recent years, some in the United States have been trumpeting the idea of decoupling from China, and sometimes it could become quite a hot topic on the media. But I wonder how many people can truly benefit from this kind of hype. According to Chinese statistics, two-way trade between China and the United States last year totaled $760 billion, which again set a new record in history.
Kyung said China and the United States can and must cooperate, and there are a lot that the two countries can achieve by working together. He stressed that encirclement and suppression are in no one's interests. The latest remarks by Xi Jinping regarding China's focus on security comes as relations with the U.S. have hit their lowest point in decades. Chinese officials had previously warned that Washington's efforts to contain Beijing's interests could lead to conflict and confrontation between the two superpowers. America's increasingly confrontational posture toward China is a significant shift in the U.S. foreign policy that needs greater scrutiny and debate. For most of the past half century, the United States sought to reshape China through economic and diplomatic engagement. In the case of the Trump administration, through economic and diplomatic disengagement. The Biden administration, by contrast, has shelved the idea that China can be changed in favor of the hope that it can be checked. The White House has moved to limit economic ties with China, to limit China's access to technology with military applications, to pull back from international institutions where the United States has long sought to engage China, and to strengthen ties with China's neighbors. In recent months, the United States has restricted semiconductor exports to China, and this week it moved ahead with plans to help Australia obtain nuclear submarines. The administration also is seeking to impose new restrictions on American investments in certain Chinese companies. In treating China as a growing threat to American interests, it is acting with broad support, including from leading Republicans, much of the military and foreign policy establishments, and a growing portion of the business community. China also is demonstrating a greater willingness to engage in worrying provocations, mounting military displays in the South China Sea and Taiwan Strait. China and the U.S. have locked themselves into a new cycle of recriminations, provoking fresh worries that the world's two biggest economies are heading down a path that could one day lead to the once unthinkable, the possibility of open conflict. The dueling narratives brought into focus how the U.S. and China increasingly have one thing in common, a growing distrust of the other side. Even worse, the escalating rhetoric is entrenching divisions that could make it harder for both sides to find a way to coexist peacefully over the long term.
In an utter disregard for the public, the French Senate has voted in favor of President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms plan, bringing the package one more step toward becoming a law. 195 members of the upper house of the French parliament voted for the legislation with 112 against. That amid days-long nationwide protests against the move. The plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, has drawn hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions, out to the streets or walk out from their jobs across France. The protests and rolling strikes have affected refineries, public transport, and garbage collections with the aim to pressure the government to withdraw the plan. Macron has argued that the procedure is essential to ensure the pension system does not run out of money. His cabinet members have praised the reforms. In a tweet, Prime Minister Elizabeth Warren wrote, "It is a key step to make a reform happen that will guarantee the future of our pension system." Now that the Senate has adopted the bill, it will be reviewed by a joint committee of lower and upper house lawmakers. If approved, the plan will be put to vote in the country's National Assembly later this week. That's where the government needs a majority to sign the bill into law. If the government fails to assemble a majority, Prime Minister Born could deploy a highly controversial constitutional tool known as Article 49(3) to push the legislation through without a vote. Elizabeth Born has repeatedly said she wants to avoid resorting to the 49(3) procedure, but she might have no other option if there is a real risk of not having enough votes. The possibility of using Article 49(3) comes as many unionists have already warned President Macron against forcing the parliament by pushing the text through without a vote from MPs of the National Assembly. Secretary General of the French CFDT Union Laurent Berger says using 49(3) would be very dangerous as it risks creating a great degree of bitterness. French unions have called for an 8th round of nationwide demonstrations on the day of voting to keep up the pressure on the government and the parliament. The opponents of the plan argue that it would penalize low-skilled workers who start their careers early while reducing their right to leisure and a long retirement at the end. Many appear ready to fight for a better work-life balance after years of being pushed to work harder. But for many others, raising the retirement age feels like the last straw. For some others, it is a red line. According to government figures, nearly 1.3 million people took to the streets Tuesday last week to vent their anger, making it the highest turnout since the start of the protest movement. The figure is indicative of the fact that the French are showing signs of burnout and a change in attitude towards the workplace. Jean Jaurès Foundation researchers found that although 60% of the French rated their job as really important in their lives in 1990, only 21% did so in October 2022. Moreover, 60% of the French say they would rather earn less and have more free time, which is itself a sign of frustration among the French public about the jobs they're working. If this trend continues to persist, no one would guess what economic repercussions will be waiting for the French society soon. From a different perspective, this frustration with the workplace clashes with the president who pitched himself as a candidate at work. For Macron, however, there is a lot at stake. Failure to reform pensions would tarnish the rest of his second and final term and stop his reformist passion dead in its tracks. On the other hand, the growing discontent with the establishment would be something the government would not want to deal with ever. Almost a decade since foreign-backed terrorists in Syria tried to pull the country into chaos, it seems an all-out war against Damascus has failed. That's according to the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. In a meeting with a large group of influential figures from various Arab and Islamic countries, Said Hassan Nasrallah asserted that many Arab states intend to normalize ties with Syria, but the United States opposes such moves. The Hezbollah chief stressed that Syria's real enemy is the United States, which is going ahead with its war and blockade against Damascus. He argued that Syria has been targeted by a U.S.-led scheme over its rejection to subdue to Washington. He pointed out that Washington's sanction measures against Damascus are failing with the help of the people and Syria's regional allies. In the televised address, Nasrallah hailed Syria for lying in the heart of a powerful axis of resistance, noting that there is confidence that the Arab country would remain at the forefront of the struggle to stand against the West. Nasrallah stressed that Syria's resistance disrupted all equations throughout the entire region. The Hezbollah leader also tied the security of Syria to its neighboring countries, namely Lebanon. He said what happens in Syria and Palestine is reflected directly on the regional countries and has a strong impact on Lebanon in particular. The prominent figure said speaking about the present and future of Syria is like speaking about the present and future of Lebanon. He noted that if Daesh terrorists, who had seized large swathes of land in Syria and Iraq from 2014 to 2017, had remained in the region, it would have affected Lebanon as well. The comments by Hezbollah leader comes as many countries, especially those in the Arab world, are gradually turning towards Syria by normalizing relations with the Arab country. Countries like the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, and Oman are among those who have recently restored their relations with Damascus. To add to the list is Tunisia, with President Rais Said announcing plans to fully restore ties with Syria, which was once cut off more than a decade ago. Needless to say that many of those countries join hand in hand with Western nations to sow division in Syria. They also helped the West impose an all-out economic sanction and blockade on Damascus. As Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has numerously said, hegemonic countries had implemented straitjacketed agendas, invested in terrorism, and put economies in a stranglehold with no regard for international law. Miqdad brands what he calls smart sanctions as a form of collective punishment against the Syrian people, who are deprived of access to food, fuel, medications, and other basic necessities. As part of sanctions, the Western world has left no stone unturned to isolate Syria. But to what extent has that scheme been successful? Since the crisis in 2011, Syria has favored dialogue, even with the opposition, to support national reconciliation and stability. Moreover, Damascus has facilitated the return of millions of refugees who once escaped a foreign-backed militancy from Syria. The Syrian government has also made all its efforts to rebuild the country after large swathes of its land were devastated by terrorist acts. From the military perspective, President Bashar al-Assad, with the support of Iran and Russia, has emerged victorious from the years-long conflict. That could especially be highlighted when the Syrian government managed to retake almost all the territory it lost to foreign-backed terrorists. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is the fact that Syria, with the help of its allies, is managing to stand firm against the West's threats. From partitioning the Arab country to plundering the country's oil, Syria is doing whatever it can to resist against the West. That's exactly what the Hezbollah leader termed as failure of the West in its war on Damascus.
Trilateral meetings in progress in the capital, Beijing. The participants: Saudi Arabia's National Security Advisor, Mossad bin Mohammed al-Eban; Iran's Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani; and Wang Yi, Director, Office of Foreign Affairs Commission, the Communist Party of China Central Committee. Then came the announcement. After 7 years, Iran and Saudi Arabia have resumed diplomatic ties. Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani expressed willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement their consensus, and enhance good neighborliness to jointly safeguard regional security.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia, while considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. Both have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. This will be followed up by the reopening of embassies and missions within a period not exceeding 2 months. Per protocol, this means the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Agreement on Security Cooperation signed on April 17, 2001, and the General Agreement reached on May 27, 1998, aimed at fostering ties in economic, commercial investment, technical, and scientific fields, to name a few. Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions. The U.S. President Joe Biden's response was clearly off the mark. He said better relations between Israel and their Arab neighbors are better for everybody. As for Israel, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It said the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the U.S. and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz, the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said, "Lose, lose, lose for American interests." This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington to have their back. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory of Iranian policy when it came to Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of his allies like the U.S. Other issues leading to the severance of diplomatic ties included how Saudi Arabia executed prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Saudi's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine, and Syria, where it has played destructive roles. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to ensure the security of West Asia would translate into a decrease of the U.S. presence in the region to its eventual withdrawal completely.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence says he knows history will hold Donald Trump accountable over the January 6th insurrection. And he also made jokes at the expense of his former boss about the secret documents found at Mar-a-Lago. Mike Pence's comments are some of the harshest he has ever made about Donald Trump. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. U.S. broadcaster CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. Former Vice President Mike Pence on Saturday, 11th of March, harshly criticized former President Donald Trump for his role in the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol, widening the rift between the two men as they prepare to battle over the Republican nomination in next year's election. "President Trump was wrong," Mike Pence said during remarks at the annual white-tie gridiron dinner attended by politicians and journalists. "I had no right to overturn the election, and his reckless words endangered my family and everyone at the Capitol on that day, and I know history will hold Donald Trump accountable." Mike Pence's remarks were the sharpest condemnation yet from the once loyal lieutenant who has often shied away from confronting his former boss. "Donald Trump has already declared his candidacy. Mike Pence has not, but he's being laying the groundwork to run." In the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021, Donald Trump pressured Mike Pence to overturn President Joe Biden's election victory as he presided over the ceremonial certification of the results. Pence refused, and when rioters stormed the Capitol, some chanted that they wanted to hang Mike Pence. The House committee that investigated the attack said in its final report that the President of the United States had riled up a mob that hunted his own vice president. With his remarks, Mike Pence solidified his place in a broader debate within the Republican Party over how to view the attack on the Capitol. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, for example, recently provided Tucker Carlson with an archive of security camera footage from 6th of January 2021, which the Fox News host has used to downplay the day's events and promote conspiracy theories. "Make no mistake about it, what happened on that day was a disgrace," Mike Pence said in his gridiron dinner remarks, "and it mocks decency to portray it any other way." Donald Trump, meanwhile, has continued to spread lies about his election loss. He's even spoken in support of the rioters and said he would consider pardoning them if he was re-elected president. Speeches at the gridiron dinner are usually humorous affairs, where politicians poke fun at each other, and Mike Pence did plenty of that as well. He joked that Trump's ego was so fragile. He wanted his vice president to sing "Wind Beneath My Wings." One of the lines is, "Did you ever know that you're my hero?" during their weekly lunches. He took another shot at Donald Trump over classified documents found at Mar-a-Lago. "I read that some of those classified documents they found at Mar-a-Lago were actually stuck in the president's Bible," Pence said, which proves he had absolutely no idea that they were there. Even before the dinner was over, Mike Pence was facing criticism for his jokes about Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, the first openly gay cabinet member in U.S. history. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Mike Pence has offered a rebuke of his one-time boss Donald Trump, saying history will hold the former president accountable for his role in the 6th of January 2021 attack on the US Capitol. Mike Pence, then vice president, was in the Capitol when thousands of Donald Trump's supporters breached the building in an attempt to stop Congress certifying the 2020 presidential election, which Trump lost to Joe Biden. As Senate President, Mike Pence presided over the ceremonial task of approving the votes of the Electoral College. Throughout the siege, Trump sent several tweets, one calling on Republicans to fight and others making false claims of voter fraud. He also criticized Mike Pence for certifying the election results. Some rioters chanted "Hang Mike Pence," a makeshift gallows was erected outside of the building. Mike Pence was spirited to safety by the Secret Service agents. On Saturday, 11th of March, at the Gridiron Dinner in Washington, Mike Pence told journalists and their guests, "President Trump was wrong. I had no right to overturn the election, and his reckless words endangered my family and everyone at the Capitol on that day. And I know that history will hold Donald Trump accountable." Mike Pence is now considering a run for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024 against Trump, the clear leader in polling. Pence rarely addressed January 6th in the months after the riot, but he has now upped his criticism of the rioters and Donald Trump himself. In a memoir released in November, he accused Trump of endangering his family. "What happened on that day was a disgrace," Mike Pence told the Gridiron audience, "and it mocks decency to portray it any other way. For as long as I live, I will never ever diminish the injuries sustained, the lives lost, or the heroism of law enforcement on that tragic day." A Donald Trump spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Mike Pence's remarks came a few days after a Fox News host, Tucker Carlson, aired highly selective, misleading security footage of the Capitol attack in an attempt to claim many rioters were orderly. Tucker Carlson's depiction was sharply criticized by Democrats and Senate Republicans. Many other Republicans, particularly in the House of Representatives, shrugged off the episode. On Sunday, 12th of March, a relatively moderate House Republican was asked if Mike Pence was right to say history would hold Donald Trump accountable for the 6th of January 2021 insurrection. Nancy Mace from South Carolina sidestepped the question. "I see this in two parts," she told CNN's State of the Union program. "I think both sides are really struggling, looking at the nomination process. You've got some on the left that don't want Biden to run, and you've got those on the right that don't want Donald Trump to run. You know, a lot of folks on both sides keep bringing up 6th of January, and it's keeping us from moving our country forward." Nancy Mace was not among the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump over the Capitol attack, making Trump's second impeachment the most bipartisan in U.S. history. Nonetheless, she also saluted her own success in defeating a challenger endorsed by Donald Trump last year and said Republicans should unite behind a candidate who can win the White House. Asked again if Donald Trump would be held accountable, Nancy Mace said, "He is one of the only candidates in right now, and we have a long way to go for additional candidates to jump in and see how the field lays out." Asked if the Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy was right to have released more than 40,000 hours of Capitol security footage to Tucker Carlson, a decision for which Kevin McCarthy has faced fierce criticism, Nancy Mace said, "I said early on it was important that it should be released to every outlet, including CNN, every media outlet, every defense attorney, so that the public can see for itself. There was violence on that day, you cannot deny that, and you know, it was a dark day in our history, but so was the summer of 2020. Nancy Mace proceeded to compare the deadly attack on Congress, now linked to 9 deaths, more than 1,000 arrests and hundreds of convictions, including some for seditious conspiracy, to protest for racial justice after the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in May of 2020. "We saw very few arrests when there were attacks by members of Antifa and Black Lives Matter. I had my house spray painted 2 summers ago, and no one's been held to account for that."
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to IRB English Radio. Thank you very much for joining us in a new episode of The House of Truth, Back to Reality. Well, I am Asma. I have the privilege to be your host. And here with me, I have Brother Hassanain from India and Sister Zainab from India as well. Well, I'm so happy to have you here both. Would you please introduce yourself very much briefly?
Assalamu alaikum. I am Zainab Askari from Indian Administrative Kashmir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum, sisters. And salaam alaikum, everyone listening to the IRIB English Radio. I'm Hassanain from India.
So, welcome, both of you. So, as we studied literature, we have been through too much of this concept that each character has got more than what you just see or just read in these pages of the book. Like, when you are going to analyze a character, you have to dig deeper and get into the utmost reality of that person, which is when they are sharing some soliloquies. That is, some words you are saying to your own self. Those moments are exactly the moments when you're showing your own true self to your own self, because we usually do not show our reality to others. It is something hidden inside of us, and in some special occasions, even we can see it ourselves. And not many people even can get into that point because they're not very much honest with themselves. Now, in reality, every single one of us has got three dimensions, three, let's say, masks on their face. One is with myself, one is with others, and the other one is
with a friend.
Yeah, with a friend. So, what do you think?
I agree. We do have masks.
Of course.
And there's a face we show to the world. There's a face we show to our family, friends. And there's a face we show to ourselves. We actually are. The face that we don't show to anyone is the real form of us.
Yeah.
So, now if the question is like, shall we be having dual faces or not? Or... I agree.
No, there's no question upon that. There is.
If
such
you arrange
a thing.
This thing in order, I guess, you know, this might be true that, you know, with ourselves is the most real one.
Yeah.
Then with our friends, then with. The
half
people.
Real, and then with people not real at all. Right?
Yeah.
So, is it called pretending? The face that we show to our friends and to the other people.
Of course we are pretending.
Why do we have to pretend?
Because we don't want others to know our real colors. We don't want to lose them, maybe. And not even Allah likes that.
To show your true self to others?
I'm not saying exactly that. But as we read in the Dua Kamal as well, like, oh Allah, forgive me for the sins that only you know. Forgive me for the sins. Like, you have not revealed what you know about me. Because if you reveal that and then... I don't know.
Nobody would look at me.
That dignity will be gone all. And it's your, you know, mercy on me that you know all about me. So there should be that one true face should be with Allah. But sometimes there are even people who are not real with even Allah. Because I known people actually, well, in their childhood. Now I don't know how they are. For example, they recite prayers when their friends are around, when the family is around. And if someone would have asked, did you offer the Zohar prayers? Like, and they would say, yeah, I did. But they never did. So here they are being, I don't know.
This is called hypocrisy.
Yeah. So they're being, as if playing with Allah as well, showing him another kind of face. But I think at least even if you have dual faces or dual personalities or multiple personalities, with your Allah should be true at least.
Yeah, so brother.
You know, as you were talking about pretending.
Yeah.
It's... you can call it pretending, but it's not always pretending.
So what
sometimes
is it?
It's your requirement, what you require for the specific moment or specific situation. Because, you know, you cannot be same with random people, with strangers, as you're with your friends.
Yeah.
It's what's the requirement of the time.
So you mean that sometimes it's logic?
Sometimes, you know, I cannot behave in the same way as I with a stranger as I behave with my friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, I'm more comfortable with my friends.
Yeah.
I'm more comfortable when I'm around my family.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, I won't be the same guy in my friend circle and in random, you know, in a random group of people.
With strangers.
Yeah. So I might be introvert when I'm outside. I might be extrovert when I'm with my friends.
Exactly.
So it's sometimes what is required.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always pretending. It might be sometimes.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's totally
true. I don't
know
the difference of
So right now that we have come to an agreement, let's go for a break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. This is still Back to Reality, and we're talking about people, human beings as in general, having different faces and different masks or whatever you just call it. Again, in literature, we have another concept that is called decorum. That is, content and form should come together. Just like what brother said, like when I am with a bunch of people who are strangers, I am going to act accordingly. As someone with shields, I'm protecting myself actually from them. And I guess this is wise. This is being wise, comporting yourself with the situation.
Yeah.
You come to act according to where you are. Of course, when I am with my friends, I'm not going to be that way with the strangers. Or the way I am with my family, I'm not going to be that way with my, for example, and with the people who have come into my life very much recently or newly, or things like that. Now, the question is, which one should we trust more? A real one or the one we create to show other people?
Obviously, the one we are.
Mm-hmm. The real one is the real you.
Because the one that you don't show to others is the real you.
No, because sometimes I come to the point that I believe that is me. You know what I mean? We have seen it many times around us, that there are people, just as you said, those hypocrite people who do things in front of other people and then they get much of, appreciation from people around them so that they come to the point where they themselves even come to believe that, okay, I am that good of a person. Not the real one, I show it to myself.
You know, first we say, you know, pretending can be according to the need of the time. Mm-hmm. Like, we act accordingly. But sometimes it's also hypocrisy.
Yeah.
You know, you showcase yourself in front of people to be a religious person, a pious person.
Yeah.
Well, indeed, actually, you're not. You sin a lot. But when you come in front of people, you show that you're a great...
Or maybe even a kind person. There are many women out there. If you look at them, you feel, oh my God, how kind she is. But if you dig
something
deeper,
outside and something
yeah,
else inside.
A monster comes out.
Yeah,
they're
so
plotting all the time.
When you're alone, that's the real yourself.
Yeah.
And sometimes it also happens, you know, when you're alone, you don't just open up yourself. You know, the real self, you know, your family or your friends, you know, the potential you have in yourself.
Yeah.
That, you know, the family, you know, brings that out in you.
Mm-hmm.
Your real self.
Exactly.
When you don't, this happens when you don't believe in yourself.
And sometimes it's not always, for example, it's not always like you have been showing good attitude, good things to others that they feel of you. Sometimes you even show the negative of you.
Yeah.
To others, but you actually are not.
Exactly.
For example,
yeah.
For
that
example,
happens as well.
Importance of saying no is something that we should be really discussing and we should be
working on that, really. Yes.
Exactly. Sometimes as a girl, I remember as a girl, we are not, we just mix up some things. That is, one is respecting others, respecting elders, respect, and then not being able to say no.
Mm-hmm.
So when you, for example, somebody is actually, she invites you something, come let's go and, like, for example, be friends with non-mahrams, because it's okay for her, but it's not according to your teachings. Mm. It's not okay
She's
for you.
She's inviting you for something
But still, you have a respect for that friend, and because of that respect, you're not able to say no to her. But in deep within you, when you're alone, you're getting hurt with this feeling,
mm-hmm.
you know? So sometimes what you show to you agree. You agreed with your friend. But deep down, alone, when you're alone, you really don't want to be friends with normal. So sometimes we pretend to be something
that we aren't.
Negative with others.
Actually, it's important to get to know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
There's hadith that says, "Man arafa nafsa,
faqad
arafa rabba." Like whoever recognizes himself, recognizes his Lord.
Allah.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to get to know yourself. And one more thing we should pay attention to over here is there might be people who are, in our surroundings, they might talk bad about you.
Mm-hmm.
Or in contrast, you know, they might, beat your trumpets. Like they might boast you.
Yeah.
So this thing makes you proud of yourself. And, you know, in contrast, like, you know, when someone's talking bad about you, this might lower your self-esteem. So, but when you know, when you recognize yourself,
when
you know who you are,
yourself,
so these things, these factors doesn't affect you.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's calling you, oh, you're such a great person, but well, in fact, reality, you know what you really are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when this trash in my hand, I close my hand, this trash in my fist, and someone comes and tells me that the diamonds in your hand. So that, but just by him telling me something, that trash doesn't change into diamonds.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this is very important.
So, you know what
important.
Is in your hands.
Yeah.
And in contrast, when there are diamonds and someone comes and tells me that there's trash in your hands, I know what it is. I know it's the diamonds in my hand.
Yeah.
So, this thing, it doesn't affect me. And so, we shouldn't let these things, like...
Affect us
or overcome us.
Yeah. So, this is very important. No matter what other people have seen of me, what my family have seen of me, I should know my truth. And then not be affected by whatever that comes from the outside world. Not to be too happy with the appreciation that comes to me, and not to be too sad with the all the reproaches that gets to me. This is Back to Reality, and this is the last part, of course. Sister Zainab was about to say something. The problem with society.
Yeah, we have one of the problems in my society, like the society that I come in from. At the time of marrying someone, now girls believe, boys believe that they are starting a new life together. And now they reveal things they should have never been revealing to each other. Like they just want to step into new life, but they start revealing things. And then they say it's very important to be honest. It's very important to be revealing everything.
Yeah.
You never know what kind of... Actually, even in Islamic teachings as well, every truth is not meant to be said. Because Prophet Moses, probably, he was praying with a group for rain.
Yeah.
And then he gets a message from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that there's one person in this group who is a sinner, and that's why your dua is not getting, you know, answered. And now, what does this person do? The person knows I am a sinner. He does the best thing a sinner can do. He apologizes to Allah.
Yeah.
And then it certainly starts raining. And then Prophet Moses asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala what happened. And he says that the person apologized. That's why rain actually came down. And then Prophet Moses says, I want to know which person it was. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, what he beautifully says here, when he was a sinner, I didn't reveal him
to you.
How can I reveal him now when he has apologized and actually come towards me?
Yeah.
This in itself teaches us a lot of things. What kinds of faces we should have, when, where, with whom, and how.
So, brother, in one sentence, the final thing.
See the situation and act accordingly.
Exactly.
And sometimes it becomes necessary to pretend. Like being a Muslim or a Muslima, when you're outside in the society and people know that you're a Muslim, sometimes you have to pretend because you're representing a community. Although no one's the representative of Islam except the Ahlul Bayt. But you know, outside in the society, what people see you as? People see you as a Muslim. So there, even if you pretend, I say it's okay because, you know, if you do something wrong, they won't say that this dude has done something wrong.
Because people's you're a kind of ambassador of that particular
community. Yeah, people are going to say, look at these Muslim guys. What are they doing? So sometimes you actually need to pretend when you're
inevitable.
Outside with the people.
Mm. Yeah, and stop pretending. Hypocrisy is not a very good thing. That's all the time that we had for today. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank could have devastating effect across the technology industry in the short term, as most of the companies that deposited their money in the bank are struggling to pay their employees. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Associated Press news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Regulators rushed on Friday, 10th of March, to seize the assets of one of Silicon Valley's top banks, marking the largest failure of a U.S. financial institution since the height of the financial crisis almost 15 years ago. Silicon Valley Bank, the nation's 16th largest bank, failed after depositors hurried to withdraw their money in recent days, amid anxiety over the bank's health. It was the second biggest bank failure in U.S. history after the collapse of Washington Mutual in 2008. The bank served mostly technology workers and venture capital-backed companies, including some of the industry's best-known brands. There appeared to be little chance of the chaos spreading in the broader banking sector, as it did in the months leading up to the Great Recession. The biggest banks, those most likely to cause an economic meltdown, have healthy balance sheets and plenty of capital. According to the bank's website, nearly half of the U.S. technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers. The bank also boasted of its connections to leading technology companies such as Shopify, ZipRecruiter, and one of the top venture capital firms, Andreessen Horowitz. Internet television provider Roku was among casualties of the bank collapse. It said in a regulatory filing on Friday that about 26% of its cash, or $487 million, was deposited at the Silicon Valley Bank. Roku said its deposits with Silicon Valley Bank were largely uninsured, and it didn't know to what extent it would be able to recover them. As part of the seizure, California bank regulators and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, transferred the bank's assets to a newly created institution, the Deposit Insurance Bank of Santa Clara. The new bank will start paying out insured deposits in the coming days. Then the FDIC and California regulators plan to sell off the rest of the assets to make other depositors whole. There was unease in the banking sector all week, with shares tumbling by double digits. The news of Silicon Valley Bank's distress pushed shares of almost all financial institutions even lower on Friday, 10th of March. The failure arrived with incredible speed. Some industry analysts suggested on Friday that the bank was still a good company and a wise investment. Meanwhile, Silicon Valley Bank executives were trying to raise capital and find additional investors. However, trading in the bank's shares was halted before the stock market's opening bell due to extreme volatility. Shortly before noon, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation moved to shutter the bank. Notably, the agency did not wait until the close of business, which is the typical approach. The FDIC could not immediately find a buyer for the bank's assets, signaling how fast depositors had cashed out. Agence France-Presse has also covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Sunday, 12th of March, said the government wanted to avoid financial contagion from the implosion of the Silicon Valley Bank, but ruled out a bailout of the institution. U.S. regulators on Friday, 10th of March, took control of Silicon Valley Bank, a key lender to U.S. startups since the 1980s, after a run on deposits made it no longer tenable for the medium-sized bank to stay afloat on its own. Investors punished the banking sector in total on Thursday, 9th of March, after Silicon Valley Bank's disclosure the day before. But by Friday, shares in some larger banks posted gains. However, regional lenders remained under pressure, including First Republic Bank, which slumped nearly 30% in two sessions on Thursday and Friday, and Signature Bank, a cryptocurrency-exposed lender, which has lost a third of its value since Wednesday evening, 8th of March. In an interview with CBS Sunday, Janet Yellen said the U.S. government wanted to make sure that the troubles that exist at one bank don't create contagion to others that are sound. She added that the government was working with the U.S. Deposit Guarantee Agency, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, on a resolution of the situation at Silicon Valley Bank, where approximately 96% of deposits are not covered by the FDIC's reimbursement guarantee. She claimed, "I'm sure that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation are considering a wide range of available options that include acquisitions." Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner said in an interview with ABC on Sunday that the best outcome would be to find a buyer for Silicon Valley Bank before markets open in Asia. Futures contracts on the flagship indices of the Tokyo and Hong Kong stock exchanges were pointing to an opening decline of just under 2%. Since Friday, there have been calls from the technology and finance sectors for a bailout. Janet Yellen said that reforms made after the 2008 financial crisis meant the government was not considering this option for Silicon Valley Bank. She said, "During the financial crisis, there were investors and owners of systemic large banks that were bailed out, and the reforms that have been put in place means that we're not going to do that again." Following the 2008 failure of Lehman Brothers and the ensuing financial meltdown, U.S. regulators required major banks to hold additional capital in case of trouble. U.S. and European authorities also organized regular stress tests designed to uncover vulnerabilities at the largest banks. National Public Radio, NPR, has also covered this story. The collapse of the U.S. Silicon Valley Bank, said to be the largest bank failure since the 2008 Washington Mutual financial crisis, has left startups re-questioning their future as the crash sends jolts across the global financial markets. Silicon Valley Bank failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money over concerns of a liquidity crisis. Stephanie Rule, a senior business analyst with NBC, tweeted that the startup companies are in deep trouble following the collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank. She said in a tweet, "Silicon Valley Bank was one of the biggest providers of venture debt to startup businesses. Oftentimes, as a requirement, startups had to keep their main bank account with Silicon Valley Bank. Those companies are in deep trouble unless they got all their dollars out in over the last few days." Shelf Engine, a 40-person startup founded in 2015 that uses artificial intelligence to help grocery stores reduce food waste, had its investors' money deposited into Silicon Valley Bank, just like the billions of dollars belonging to companies and investors that the bank held. The startup's chief executive officer and co-founder, Stefan Kalb, had been following news of the Silicon Valley Bank and had immediately opened an account at JP Morgan Chase just to attempt to transfer every last penny out of the sinking financial institution. After making continuous attempts of withdrawing $42 billion from the bank on Thursday, 9th of March, Kalb hoped that the transfer would have been successful, but to his nightmare, it was not. Apart from the US, the bank failure also sent its waves to countries like Britain. In Britain, the Finance Ministry and the Bank of England said they are working together to minimize the disruptions that may arise from the collapse.